It means to be faithful to you, to love justice, to do kindness, and to walk humbly with you. Help us now as we seek to learn more about what it means to be just. Guide us with the presence of your Holy Spirit through Christ our Lord. Amen. Amen. My name is Grant Abbott. The course is called Making Moral Decisions. This is the fifth and last session called But Is It Fair? And what I hope to do today, and all I think I can do today, is just to reveal to those of you who don't already know, or to confirm for those of you who do know, that this whole area is one of controversy now. There's no sort of overarching theory that everybody accepts. There's a lot of diversity. And when we start going around saying that something is just or unjust, we really need to know something about what we're talking about, especially as Christians and as members of the church, so that we can speak with humility and with integrity about the issues we're discussing. My name, did I say my name was Grant Abbott? I did that okay? No, okay, I've done this enough. I'd say who I am. No, I don't. I just read that I'm supposed to give my name. So, what I want to do again is start with some dilemmas, and I've intentionally written some things here in the back to so you can look at it. The writing may be absolutely too small to see, but it's there so that after our session you can copy some of this stuff down. If you don't have time to write it, a lot of this is right in the book by Karen LeBach called Six Theories of Justice, which is available in the bookstore. But I bring this up as we're discussing these dilemmas to think about some of the general considerations of justice, and that there are alternative forms of distributive justice when we talk about it. And there are different theories. The predominant secular theories in our world today, and I have not added the Marxist theories here, okay? We just don't have time. So I was thinking in the West, utilitarianism, contract theory of John Rawls, and entitlement theory of Robert Nozick. And then because I don't have time to put liberation theology and other things out, I'm just using as from Karen LeBach's book, because I think in some in my feeling it has the most depth, is the U.S. Roman Catholic Bishop's statement on the U.S. economy, which reveals to us Roman Catholic social philosophy and their understanding of justice. So these are just sort of up there in the background when we're talking about these things, and to help us expand some of our questions or ideas that we have about these dilemmas. So if you turn to the back page, those of you who have the sheet, if you don't, try to look on with somebody else, or else listen. And I will read these as slowly as I can. And then remember, this is just the beginning of the dilemma, and we will keep expanding it as we go. Number 10, your city's fire department has no women on its force. The city council agrees to accept all women who pass the exam before other men who are equally qualified until there are at least 10% women firefighters. Is this fair? Why?
I think it's unfair, and my statement would be that it ought to be that that be the condition until there are 50% women firefighters.
Oh. Wow.
Okay.
I'd ask who are we trying to be fair to?
Okay.
Who's it fair?
Okay.
I guess there are three answers to that. Is it fair to the men? Is it fair to the women? But the one I would like to advance, the question is it fair to the people whose houses may burn down?
Okay. Want to respond?
Presumably the exam was structured so that is assured.
Okay. By the way, when you say, please speak your name so we can...
My name is Liz.
Hi, Liz. So you, these women, because they're equally qualified with the men, therefore would not be jeopardizing the safety of the fire department. And
you think that it's unfair that women have been discriminated against in the past with respect to serving as firefighters, and 10% doesn't represent an adequate representation of women in society, so it ought to be 50%. Okay? What about all those guys that are doing just as well and aren't getting in?
That's not as fair to them.
What about all the women who are doing just as well and not getting in?
Well, they aren't. They're going to get in now. All the women that are doing just as well are going to get in.
Well,
until the quota's met. Until the quota's met, they'll be
able. It seems to me that perhaps...
This is Dean, by the
Dean.
Way.
Oh, Dean. It strikes me that the question of fairness is perhaps not the valid one here. You can be fair to one person you hire, you're unfair to somebody else you don't hire. Any system like this, I think, should be evaluated on the question, is there an overall need of the community for placing more women in positions that they have been excluded from? Is there a need to restructure our society, to put women in more visible positions?
How would we...
I would go on to say that I would say, in general, one could answer this sort of question by yes. All of this affirmative action is debated in terms of fairness. And this does not seem to me to be the proper question to raise. Is there a problem, a disease in our society that we're trying to rectify or overcome with something like this? It goes much beyond, are we being fair to you or to you, depending on which one gets the job.
Okay, so you're looking at the overall need of the community in determining whether or not the community wants to do something like this. That's what I'm hearing.
I'm not sure I like that phrase, what the community wants to do, because often the community wants to do things that are really not what should be done.
Okay.
But looking from the real need of what the community should have to be a true community, is this desirable?
Okay.
My name is Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
And Dean, you said the word generally. Well, I'm speaking specifically. We have a lot of single households where the mothers are living on welfare because there's no jobs that they can earn a decent wage to raise their children. And if I agree with Denise,
Liz,
that 50% should be filled with women, if 50% of the households with children have not a living wage coming into that household.
Do you want to go farther and specify that you look at the particular need for income
family? Knowing me, I would have been there at the city council meeting when they discussed that issue.
Well, I think that you have a good point, that there are a lot of women who need these jobs. But if that is our policy, I think we need to go beyond what you're suggesting, just simply a quarter of 50% women, and really ask each individual candidate, are you the head of a household with kids dependent on you, no other source of income, and really need the job?
Well, a criteria would have had to be set up by the city council. And I would have been there in the audience to help design that criteria.
My name is Greg. I just want to put kind of a general comment. Having been through the period when the similar situation on hiring blacks began to happen, the great thing about quotas, one great thing, is that all of a sudden management began looking harder for the qualified candidates. It was awfully easy to ignore them up to then, if you preferred not to have them. That was one good thing about quotas. Mm-hmm. whether or not it is, in the end, truly fair. I admit it's a difficult question.
The difficulty I have with deciding in a fashion other than just something like a percentage quota, as Dean was suggesting, is that, you know, and this is probably the crux of the discussion today, is how do you decide in another way what's fair? You know, he was saying you need to look at what's needed or what, I don't remember exactly how you stated it, but something about what was needed or what was most appropriate. And my question is, who decides that and how? You know, that becomes very complex.
Who does decide that and how? It's a good question to pursue.
Well, let me advance another thought here. I think any job in our economy has two purposes. One is to do a specific job or produce something. The other is to provide employment and income for the person who's being hired. And I think in deciding who you want to hire for any job, you've got to balance these two objectives. There are, I think, many jobs where perhaps doing it well is not all that important, and it's quite legitimate to ask, to look at this in terms of who needs the job. How can we be fair to the person who is applying for the job? There are other positions, and maybe particularly the ones at the top of the structure. Chief surgeon at a hospital is a good example, where I think we want and feel we need the very best person, where we really, I think, want to put the emphasis on not who deserves this job, but who do we deserve to have serving us in this job.
Let's make this a little more complicated, and let's say that somebody has done their work and found out that over the past 20 years, women have been discriminated against. The test has been arbitrary to exclude women, and that equally qualified women have not been hired, and men have been, there's a historical record that men have been chosen over equally qualified women. And that is the background to this. Then what do you do? Yes.
I'm thinking, but it seems to me, of course, I mean, it's only fair if you hire the person most qualified, but it seems like affirmative action, the whole point of it, is that somebody, it has not been fair to somebody for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that economic injustice, and you go all the way back to slavery with the blacks, and so it hasn't been fair to blacks, the whole system. And so affirmative action is trying to fix something that wasn't fair. And so in a sense, it's not fair to the men to give 10% of the jobs to women. Of course, it wasn't fair to the women to not give any of the jobs to them for the last 20 years. So I think it's not fair, probably isn't the word, but it's trying to right a wrong that already happened. And so initially, I think you're going to get some less than qualified people in, but eventually, you're going to get the best person, and it's going to be whoever it happens to be.
But if it's not fair, should we do it?
Yeah, because it wasn't fair for the last 200 years either.
So that there is, in the historical picture, I'm hearing you say, Vicky,
yeah,
that over historical time, it will be fair. But maybe in this little period of time, it may appear to be unfair in the sense that people who are living now and taking this exam are bearing the brunt of injustice that was inflicted before their time, and so they're paying for the sins of their fathers.
Like,
and
that's okay for me to do because of what has happened in the past.
Okay.
I would suggest, though, that it would be unfair to the men applying if you attempted to balance that injustice of the 20 years. In other words, if you said, we are going to take now, you know, the history of the last 20 years shows us that there's only been 5% women firefighters. And so now we're going to make it so that
for another 20 years, eventually we're going to work so that there's only 5% male firefighters, and we're going to make it be that way for 20 years, and then we'll equalize it. You know, and I don't hear it, we haven't discussed anything like that here. That would be unfair to the males, I feel like. And, but maybe I heard you wrong, Vicki, but it sounded to me like you were suggesting that somebody might see it as being unfair that we do a 50% ratio. And that perhaps that would require hiring somebody who is not quite qualified. And I guess my supposition has been that they need to be qualified, and if there aren't 50% women who are qualified, then that would, you would not be able to meet that quota. Because I agree with Dean, you really need to have a qualified person in certain jobs such as this. And so I guess I would say that unless you were kind of overbalancing that to try to fix that last 20 years, if you're just going for a 50% quota, I can't see that that's unfair in any way, shape, or form.
What about in some cases, Liz, where I think it's the case that I've heard where there is a reach over, and you will pick the highest qualified woman that takes the test, even though perhaps she has not gotten an equal score with somebody else, and pick her over. Would you be supportive of that kind of a process?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think you'd need to have some sort of bottom cutoff below which people below that were not qualified. You have to have some sort of definition of qualified, and there might be somebody who had, I mean, let's say 75% on the test or whatever is going to be qualified, and there might be a 76% and there might be a 98%. You know, one is more qualified in some way, at least on that test, for that job. And so I suppose in order to meet your 50% quota for women, you might be in a position of having to pick a woman who had a 76% on the test versus a man who had a 98% on the test. I would view that as fair as long as she had gone into the category of qualified, but somebody had, some qualified person had selected.
Okay, Dave, you have, this is Dave back here.
Yeah, and maybe it's just inherent to the situation, but in the situation of firefighters and of historical injustice, if one wants to look at that, I think maybe in this particular case, though, I would question, one side may question whether in the past there has been that, I would want to see data on whether there has been that much of an interest upon women in getting into that profession, in terms of you're talking about firefighters, because frankly, I mean, the 50s and 60s, I don't think that was a high priority item. And because of social and economic changes in our society, now women want want a more active role and need a more active role economically. But I think this is not as good an example as some others in terms of what. And I think also one other point is that right before I came out here, like about a week ago, the Supreme Court, I believe, just made a ruling that limited further the affirmative action programs that are in place right before we came out. So.
Right, this dilemma is taken from the city of St. Paul, which recently has had no women firefighters, and its test was ruled to be biased against women, and they're in the process of rectifying this situation here. But all these things are good. I would like to then move down to 13, and if we can. And this dilemma is a real case that I believe I read about in Newsweek magazine. I'm not sure I have all the details correct. But your church recognizes that there are hungry and homeless people wandering near your church. You decide to open a feeding and housing program. Its success brings more people to use your services. Some people in the neighborhood begin to complain that you're disturbing the peace of the neighborhood by attracting undesirables. They begin to press the local community council to have your program shut down. What do you do?
Okay, sure. City takes over the program. We won't need it. We'll shut it down. As soon as the city takes care of all the homeless, we'll be happy to shut our doors.
Okay. That's what Marjorie says. Sarah?
I think that it's always, that in most cases, it's uncomfortable to see people who are homeless or hungry around you because most of us aren't homeless or hungry, and so people usually have complaints like that. There's just too many of these people around. I think that it's important that we're reminded of the social ills that we have, and I would fight to keep the program going one, to provide the services that would be provided to these people, and two, to keep the reminder that there are these people around.
Okay.
I'm Phyllis. We have had situations of this kind in Seattle, not so much with feeding programs, but with low-income housing. And it is my sense that it's important to involve the neighborhood itself, that it's difficult to plunk a program like that in the midst of a neighborhood that is that has never had something like that, and to involve the neighborhood to the best of your ability in the program itself, and if there then are continuing complaints, to really set up some kind of negotiation or communication between the church and the neighborhood would be the first way I would want to do it.
So there's a sense in which the church, by reaching out with this program without the consultation of the community, the neighborhood around it, in a sense, violates the right of the community by not informing them and involving them in the decision and knowing what's going on. Let's say that the church does do this. It does reach out and goes to the community council and suggests it, but the city council says no, or the community council in this case, it's a neighborhood. The community council says no, we don't want it here. What should the church do in that case? Assuming now that there is a real need here, there's insufficient housing and insufficient feeding programs for the hungry and homeless in your community.
Well, I would personally support the church doing that, and as I support some of the churches who have violated the law in being refugee centers. What is the name of them?
Sanctuary.
Thank you.
Okay.
We grant
money yes.
this March.
Yeah.
And I've long been an advocate of congregations or churches asking the community what they expect of them in ministry, since the congregation exists because the community gives them tax-exempt status and therefore takes taxation out of the community coffers, mm-hmm. whatever that is, county, city, state. So therefore, it's the community in a way that owns that property, and we ought to be asking our neighborhoods more, what do you expect of us because you allow us to be here without
okay.
taxation?
So that what I hear Marge saying is that the community does have, in a sense, a kind of claim on the church, because by taking the property off the tax rolls, it takes away money that the community could use otherwise for programs like feeding and housing. That's a good point. Dave.
Grant, just before that, Peter Rognes is a bishop of the ALC Church in southeastern Wisconsin, wrote an editorial in the Milwaukee Journal, which stressed that the church needs to be antagonistic and critical of the greater society that they live in, and not acquiescent of the norms of society, that it needs to set the agenda itself, and that what it feels is God's way and God's purpose, it needs to push that even in conflict with the societal expectations. So, and I see this as a clear case in that point, where the church needs to take a stand on this is what how we should treat people, and that perhaps it will pry society into doing something about it.
Okay.
I live in New Jersey, but I, of course, read the New York papers and know what's happening in New York, this city for sale. They had a case where the city determined that in a residential area, homes costing somewhere in the neighborhood of $200,000 or more, they were going to put a drug halfway house. And they just one day, all of a sudden, bought this property and put the halfway house in there without consulting the community. And I support those of you who say you've got to consult with the community, because within a week that house was torched and completely burned down because the community was opposed to it. This happened also in a case where they had
try to set up a home. Of course, that's New York City. That's the way they react. But they also try to do the same thing with children who had been abandoned. And that place, too, was soon shambles, bombed, and things like that. So it's really essential, I think, that you get the community support. And you can't force that, but at least not in New York, because New Yorkers will react.
Once, Vicki, I think your hand was first, and then your name is...
Well, yeah, I just think that a lot of times people, if they were to hear about it first, their whole response is different, because I think people are angry when they feel that something has been decided about their neighborhood without their knowledge. And I think if they've been approached at, like they were the first ones to know, you know, we're telling you before we tell anybody, I think the response to the whole thing could be different.
Okay. Doug.
The experience that we've felt in some of our issues around Portland is that even if the community finds out about it, it gives them time to get up in arms and mobilize, and things like halfway houses and shelters for women, low-income housing, they're all fought. It's like the community doesn't want to have a part of those. It wants to kind of get them out of sight and out of mind. And support what Dave said about maybe the church finds a healthy tension between being antagonistic and working with the community. We can't just shove these things, you know.
Okay. Yes,
back
Liz.
The corner.
Well, I think if many of us here, and I'm including myself in this, I think if many of us here were to think about it very honestly, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, it's probably wrong, but I think if many of us here were to think about this really honestly, in the nice neighborhoods that probably most of us live in, if someone came and put a drug halfway house with my next door to my children, it's all very well and good to sit here and say, oh, this is a necessity and this is something we should have in our communities and this is something we should push, and all of those sorts of things. And we're kind of getting off the original thing here, but I'm thinking of halfway houses and undesirables. It's all very well and good to sit here and say that in philosophy, but I think if everybody were to really think about how they would react emotionally if that happened next door to them, I would bet that almost all of us would have a different reaction than what we would sit here and discuss.
Why do you think that is, Liz?
For myself, and I can't answer for others, of course, but for myself, it would be that I purely and simply would not want my children to be in an environment that I thought crime might be enhanced in. I would feel them to be at some sort of risk. Because of
I'd like to say
and
something.
I would feel very differently. Maybe I'm wrong about this, maybe I'm cloaking it, but I feel that I would feel very differently if my children weren't involved. If it were just myself.
Okay. Norm raised his hand, and then Sarah.
Yeah, it's economics, I think, largely. It's the syndrome that's known as NIMBY, not in my backyard.
Right.
An airport is great, but I'd like to build it over there, not over here. So a halfway house is just the thing we need, but over there, not here, you see. And it's NIMBY, I think, is the word.
And I'm not so sure. I feel real good about myself because I feel that way, but if I to be very honest with myself, that is how I feel.
Sure.
Well, isn't there a sense? Let's be honest here. I'm trying to bring up some principles here. Is not part of the problem is that you feel that you are bearing an unfair burden by having this right next to you, whereas somebody living 5 miles away doesn't have to bear that same burden. They may have to pay the taxes to support a program, but they don't have to bear the increased vulnerability and perhaps the depreciation of property that you have to bear. And so you say, why should I bear this for somebody? So maybe if there were some compensation, some increased police, there'd be some way. I'm just trying to bring these things up. Sarah here and then Sarah there.
Okay. Well, I think it's kind of a problem of a lack of awareness. We have a halfway house in our community way away from my neighborhood. And I've taken my kids to it to help serve at it. And before my daughter went, she says, I don't want to go, Mom. And I says, well, you don't have to go, but it's safe. And I says, what are your concerns? And she says, I'm afraid I'll get lice. She goes, and she eagerly goes now, time after time. I've approached our hospital personnel manager. I would think that maybe part of our contracts should become that we, part of our benefit program would be that we get paid for community service. And then we will get more people involved in their community governments and in community service. If you went and spent 8 hours at a halfway house, if you can financially tie people into performing for their fellow man, assisting their fellow man, then it becomes easier, and maybe some of this fear will fall away.
Okay. Sarah?
I think it was interesting that you talked about the unfair burden, you know, that would feel like those of us who live in nicer neighborhoods feel like we're bearing an unfair burden in holding some sort of service like this in our neighborhoods. But for those of us who don't live in the nice neighborhoods and where all of these things kind of get stuck and pushed away into our corner, then actually it's an equalizing, it's equalizing the burden if they're spread out through the whole city.
Okay, Doug?
Well, I was thinking you might have a reverse, this is getting some kind of a solution, a reverse tax where people that are in the neighborhood and you put a certain facility there that they get a lower amount on their property taxes, or where the rest of the society pay for that neighborhood.
So balancing off the cost with certain benefit. I wonder if that's ever been tried.
Negative.
I've never heard of it. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Dean, and then Rand, and then Mark.
This example, the church is the one who is providing a good service, and the community objects. I think it's well to keep in mind that the church, the local congregation, may be on the other side. There was an incident in Pasco, Washington, in the past year. I forget what it was. I think it was an alternative school that they wanted to move out into a different neighborhood. The principal objection to that came from the congregation of the local church next to which it was to be moved. And primarily because of the objection of this one church, the idea has been abandoned.
Okay, Rand.
Yeah, I hope we're coming around to the point about who says it has to be fair. Here I sit, you know, 72 years old, white hair, and the worst thing that ever happened to me is I twisted my knee. And who said it's gonna, is that fair?
Yeah. Well, we'll get into that when we go over this stuff. That's a nice quote from Jimmy Carter. Got in a lot of trouble for that, didn't he?
Well,
when he said that.
Maybe you have to start to get some white hair. But that's not the right thing to say. But there is a growing awareness, you know, and luckily, the 20-year-olds that get it when they're 20 are lucky, in a way. It's not too nice a feeling sometimes that you had to wait till you're 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 to be aware. Okay.
Mark?
Maybe the whole thing is just being forced to do something. And I'm trying to think of, and maybe somebody else can inform me, about the, wasn't it Boston that made an arrangement with some suburban areas around it? They bust the homeless out to some empty places, made a contract arrangement, brought them out at night, bust them back to the city in the morning. And in the process, because they'd made this contract arrangement, this small town or whatever it was right outside, found that they liked the idea of serving the homeless in their area. But the arrangement had been made so that pretty soon people were not only providing this space for them to stay at night, but we're bringing in dinners for them.
Took them work.
Serving breakfast. And then they were bussed away.
What I'd like to do now is cut this off. We could go on forever, because I'd like to start going over these things. And some of you may know more about this than I. Not claiming that I know everything at all about these various theories, but I do want to say something about it. And then think about these as they relate to the two dilemmas we've talked about and others that you faced. And then feel free to interrupt me as I go along. I haven't written everything that I'm going to say on the board, but sort of the most important things here. way back with Aristotle, there was a statement of what is known as a formal principle of justice, meaning it doesn't have, you know, material specific content. It's just sort of a form in which you can decide whether something is a principle of justice, and it reads, likes should be treated alike. It's not very complicated. Or equals ought to be treated equally and unequals unequally. Not particularly complex. And then Aristotle thought about this and thought about it in relationship to three different forms of justice. Distributive justice, distributing shares, distributing benefits and burdens among the community. Retributive justice, penalties for people who violate other people's rights, or the rectification of injustice. And exchange, justice in terms of buying and selling, giving and receiving. And then, unrelated to this, when we look at the question of distributive justice, we need to remember that people have offered different kinds of criteria, different kinds of criteria. Equal shares, pure egalitarianism, individual needs, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs, Communist Manifesto. That person's rights, you know, what right does a person have to this? Individual effort, who's working the hardest? Societal contribution, who's making the most important contribution to what we are doing together? And then merit, who really deserves it? So there are these different criteria, and you know, sort of think about our, you know, the dilemmas that we were dealing with, and think about, you know, the sharing of benefits and burdens and shares, and how we are, what, given what we've been saying, what criterion or criteria were we using? Okay. Then, over here, this will be hard for people in here to see, but I put up the three predominant, in the language of sort of the world today, secular humanist theories, but the non-religious theories of justice that dominate discussion here in the United States. The traditional theory is utilitarianism, and its basic principle is simply utility, or the greatest happiness principle, holds that actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness, wrong as they tend to produce the reverse of happiness, or the greatest good for the greatest number for the long term. Okay, that was brought out again, especially this, by Dick Buescher, who was here this week. It's sort of the general way that it's talked about. And this particular theory sees that the goal of life is happiness, and that the rightness and wrongness of acts depends on that, how it relates to that particular goal. And there are problems with this. The calculus is sometimes thought to be too complicated, and we talked about that before. There are too many questions. What good? Which good? Who's good? When do we do the goods? And how do we divide this thing up? When we're doing the calculus, is it the greatest good, or is it the greatest number, or is it the greatest good or the greatest number? And how do you put this together? You know, what happens if I have 52 people who have the benefit turns out to be 106, but I have 32 people and the benefit is 110, and if I look at the greatest good for the greatest number, I can get about 48 at 96. You know, how just, so there's problems with that. There are other questions about the fact that it seems that utilitarianism can, in certain cases, call for the violation of the rights of others. It doesn't seem fair that particular individuals should pay an unfair burden or have their rights denied. In other words, a small group of people enslaved for the sake of others, somebody who is required to die that others may live, but that seems to be required. If we're talking about the greatest good for the greatest number. Also, in other cases, it seems to call for
what are known as supererogatory acts rather than just traditional moral acts, like the poor woman who gets $10 and she can feed her family. But actually, if she gave that $10 away to somebody else in Africa, it could feed far more people than just her own family. So greater good would be achieved if she gave that $10 to Lutheran World Relief so that people could be fed than if she just used it herself. So that's why there's some things about utilitarianism that just seem to be a problem. Though, with respect to government public policy, this is the dominant criterion that is used. I mean, as Marjorie was telling us, if you go to school in public administration, you get cost-benefit analysis, correct? That's it, with not a whole lot of discussion or appreciation about the rights of others or about a sense of the individual being more than just an individual and a part of a community. I think we're going to see some things that are similar in these theories that are very different when we look at our own biblical Christian tradition of justice. And one of them here again is this idea of the individual being central, liberty being central, and reason being central. Okay. John Rawls, uneasy with utilitarianism, wrote a fantastic book called The Theory of Justice, which continues and continues and continues to be critiqued. It's got a lot of problems, but it's a masterpiece that has dominated discussion of justice for the last, published in 71, it's now 89, 18 years people have been studying this work of his. He has tried to develop a contract theory of justice based on the contract ideas of Locke and Rousseau and Kantian principles of autonomy and freedom of the individual. And he has a particular method that I won't go into about how individuals come to choose these principles called the original position behind the veil of ignorance. It's going to get too technical if we talk about that. Let's just look at the principles that he comes up with. And these are in serial order. In other words, this is first, that's second, A is before B. Okay? Each person is to have an equal right to the most extensive basic liberty compatible with a similar liberty for others. Each person is to have an equal right to the most extensive basic liberty compatible with a similar liberty for others. So liberty is primary, right? Equality is also there. Liberty and equality are bound together here. Two, social and economic inequalities, they're permitted, so it's not purely egalitarian, are to be arranged so that they are both a reasonably expected to be to everyone's advantage, and he adds a little proviso later on in his work that says, in particular, the least advantaged members of society, and there should be a closed bracket there. And B, attached to positions and offices open to all. In other words, there must be fair opportunity for everybody. Okay? So that's basically what Rawls comes up with. And for me, when I read Rawls, that I sort of like that. Sounds good to me. It's the idea of a society in which we allow freedom for everybody. Well, first of all, we allow everybody equally. Before we know where we are in society and what we're about and what our physical condition is and stuff, to come together and make a choice of the rules we're going to play by. And we know enough about life to know how those rules are going to work themselves out. And we choose these rules that we're going to play by. And then it's just basic, it's not a teleological system like utilitarians. It's strictly Kantian. Once the rules are adhered to, it doesn't matter what the outcome is. That's why it's called justice is fairness. You just play the game. But the game is going to be fair. But when you think about what people would choose in that kind of a situation, not knowing exactly where they're going to be, we'd want liberty. But we might want to allow inequalities if that's going to benefit everybody, right? And then because we might ourselves be, we might end up at the very bottom, we might want special consideration for the least advantaged members of society.
you know, if there are going to be these inequalities and there are going to be benefits to everybody, probably ought to help the least advantaged the most. And then we want to make sure that if there are going to be these opportunities for inequality, anybody ought to be able to occupy those positions or offices, not just certain people. Now this gets very, very complex, and you can read in Labak's book, or you can read tons of stuff about it, or read the book itself, and marvel at the man's work. It's about a 530-page book, so I earn you on that. Well, Robert Nozick just looked at Rawls's work, and Nozick also is at Harvard, like Rawls. Also liberal in their understanding, again, liberty and freedom and the individual and autonomy. Nozick just said, wait a minute. These pattern forms of distributive justice are wrong because they violate the rights of people who have honestly gone about what they've done to get what they've gotten. Why should somebody have something taken away from him or herself if they've fairly gone about getting what they're doing? It just isn't fair. It isn't right. And also, it is ahistorical. Because there is, you know, how can you impose this? At what point? Because I have entitlements based on past contracts and dealings I have that allow me to have certain things, because they are fair. And so Nozick wrote a book called Anarchy, State, and Utopia, which justifies only the minimal state as the best state for society, that guarantees security and fairness in exchange, and allows people then the greatest freedom to be able to carry out their transactions. It is a libertarian theory of justice. And he really is cute. He gets it down to real simple, you know, like Marx said, from each according to their abilities, to each according to any. He has, from each as they choose, from each as they choose, so you give your money, he gives your money to what she chooses to do, okay? To each as they are chosen. Ren has a nice boat, offers to take people up in the San Juan Islands, has money, I make a deal, I pay him the money to take my family up in the San Juan Islands, he's entitled to what I pay him. It's a fair deal, the information is equal, I've gotten my things fairly, he's gotten his things fairly, it's fair exchange, so he's entitled to them. So therefore he's concerned with only three things: justice in the acquisition of holdings, justice in the transfer of holdings, and the rectification of injustice. And he does subscribe to what's called the Lockean proviso: people can freely acquire something by mixing their labor with it, so long as to do so does not harm others or make them worse off. So in other words, you can't acquire something like a monopoly on something, okay? That because you have that, you can charge an exorbitant fee and therefore make people worse off than if there were competition, with lots of people having that and therefore competition for the prices and keeping the market going. This theory is the darling of many people whose names you can imagine, because it gets the whole idea of social welfare out of there. You know, there is no social welfare. This is sort of pure market capitalism, Adam Smith. It is this idea of justice and exchange and entitlements, and it's historical, and it recognizes that people have a right to what they get fairly. However, that's the question. People have said, this is great, but how do we find out, in a world dominated by injustice and domination and inequalities that make it almost to the point where information and stuff is unfair, have our holdings been acquired fairly? And are the transfers really just? Some of you played Star Power the other day.
when you have an awful lot and somebody doesn't have very much, is that kind of transfer really as equal as we might think? And then something that he mentions we must have but doesn't deal with very much is, well, we were talking about this earlier, how do you rectify past injustices? What do you do with those Indian tribes that have lost their land and for years and now want it back, but what about the people that bought it thinking they had it fairly and now they got to give it back? You know, how do you deal with that? And then other questions like, well, is this really the only areas in which justice applies? And this is, it seems to me, liberalism, libertarian views of justice are liberalism to the extreme. The individual, the free individual, free, autonomous, rational individual is the most important thing that we have going for us. Any infringement upon that is detrimental to the person, except insofar as we have the state to protect us and give us security and to allow us to exercise our freedom so long as we don't hurt anybody else. Okay?
Can we promote this?
Pardon?
You really promoting this?
Well, Ronald Reagan promoted it for 8 years. He's the most popular president we've ever had in the United States. And it's very, very popular. Very popular. So that people are now, because they're writing about, they're seeing a lot of these problems. And interestingly enough, Labatt in her book points out that Nozick's theory actually helps liberation theology people, because, you know, that's just what they need to do, is to show that, guess what? We are making this big stink because what's happened is you acquired this unfairly.
I'm thinking of the 13 ruling parties in El Salvador, families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the only way to take care of this in a natural evolution, there will be a revolution.
Right. So what they say is that, well, this is a good idea. Let's go back and see if these holdings are in fact fair. Mm-hmm. And in fact, finding out they aren't. And finding out the reasons why the transfers were not fair, which leaves us then to the question of how do you rectify that injustice? And so it's funny that, I mean, Nozick in some ways could be used by almost the other extreme to change their situation. And that's some of the interesting discussion that Labatt points out and people are picking up, which of course makes some people very nervous. You know? They think that this is supposed to act in another way. But the main thing is that, is that really the way individuals get together? Is that really the way governments are formed, just to secure people? Is Hobbes really right? I mean, are people, individuals, really at war with one another in a state of nature? Do we really only get together to protect our security? Or are there other reasons? Are human beings innately social? Do we come together just because we like to have community? We enjoy being with one another? Or because we recognize that you can get pleasure because somebody else can do this while I do that, and there's just more to it than simply securing our persons and protecting our exchanges. And this comes out, it seems to me, strongly when you look at as carefully worked out a statement as the Catholic Bishop's Statement on the U.S. Economy, which goes back into centuries of Roman Catholic teaching about social justice. And we see the difference of what it means to come out, not of the Enlightenment, but out of our Christian heritage. And we see these three basic affirmations: the inviolable dignity of the human person. Now, not some Kantian idea, but again, because we are children of God. Okay. The essential social nature of human beings. We are born to be in community with one another. You don't have a fulfilled human being apart from community. It is in relationship that we find out who we are and by which we can fully develop who we are. And then the belief that this is the biggest difference. The belief that the abundance of nature and of social living is given by God for all people.
all that is belongs to God and has been given for the upbuilding of the body. So that I happen to be 7 feet tall and an outstanding basketball player, it's not just, that's not just for me. It's for me, yes, but it's not just for me. You know, I have not earned the fact that I'm 7 feet or I've been given this ability. I may have some role in it though, because I worked darn hard to do this. So I get some benefit out of it, but so does the community as a whole have a claim on my gifts and my talents. Okay?
What is social living in that context?
Well, social living would be all the economic benefits beyond nature that we develop as a community. We're not just developing them individually, we are developing them in cooperation with one another. And because they are developed in cooperation by talents and gifts that God has given to us, and using the resources that God has given to us, the community as a whole has a claim on that and can use those for the sake of the common good, and individuals alone don't have the right to use it just simply for themselves. Then, at that time already? Moral policies for economic life must be shaped then by 3 questions. What do they do for people? What do they do to people? And this is important because we talked about this earlier, how people participate in them. So it's not just if the policy is good for me, it does good things for me, it's also the question, did I have anything to do with it? Was I treated as a human being? This is very important to the Roman Catholic bishops. It's not just doing things for people, it's enabling people to do things for themselves and to participate with full human dignity in the human community. So anything that disables people from participating with that kind of dignity is unjust and ought to be rectified so that people have that right. And then as a result, with special concern for how they affect the poor. The preferential option for the poor, because in the scriptures, throughout the scriptures, God seems to be concerned about the poor. throughout, there is that deep concern. Matthew, 25 to 31, whatever, about the when I was hungry, you came and you fed me, and there's this concern for the least of these, your brothers and sisters. Then out of that come 3 priority principles. They get much more specific than these other ones. Fulfilling, number one, highest priority, fulfilling the basic needs of the poor. Number 2, increasing participation for the marginalized. And 3, this is interesting, investment policies should be directed to benefiting those who are poor or economically insecure. Why? Because there is this sense that even if you have a greatest good for the greatest number in one sense, that for individuals, there's something about the health of the human community that is more important than individuals having more things. In other words, I talk about this in my neighborhood. What would we all be willing to give up in terms of our economic benefits in order to be able to not lock our doors anymore, and so that our kids and our wives, mothers, daughters can walk the streets at night without fear? In some ways, we can gain all kinds of things economically as individuals and put walls and locks around our homes and then lose that sense of community. And that is, according, I think, to our tradition, just a violation of what it means to be fully human, and is radically different from these Enlightenment theories over here. Thank you very much. I have a couple of bibliographies left if anybody wants.